Right. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Michael Collins from UVA Extension Cooperative Extension. I'm a state specialist in financial economics and family finances. And I'm here today to talk about the topic of protecting elders from financial abuse. This is part of the lunchtime learning series. So if you're newer to family living programs or newer to extension, you may not know about this series, but we essentially offer these during the sort of academic school year from September to May or so, on the third Monday of each month, and in this noon time slot. And the idea is to provide some updates or some just-in-time information around topics that are of import for financial educators around the state of Wisconsin, to generate some conversation among the educators on the line today, and to share some resources that might be available. So the topics for this series are generated from educators. So last spring and in March, April, May, I had asked various educators there, both on these calls and in other settings, what topics they thought were important in the year ahead. And so you'll see on the website, fyi.uwex.edu/financial series, the topics for this year that have been set out for each month's call. Today's topic, we're going to talk about financial abuse of seniors. A topic which came up a lot, actually. It's the first topic we're going to tackle this year, in part because it's a topic that has been raised by educators in family living and other service and other settings as well as being an important one. It's also a topic that has gotten a lot of attention nationally in the last even couple of weeks as federal regulators and other agencies have begun to pay more attention to this issue. So today's call, I'm going to give an overview of some of the issues that we see in the area of financial abuse of seniors, and then begin to start a conversation about what you might do about it as an educator. What are some of the strategies that you might engage in with either community partners or even directly working with people in your communities around these issues? There are some really good new resources that have been developed by some agencies at the federal level, at the national level, both through the federal government and nonprofits as well, that I think are useful and potentially can be materials or curricula that you could use in an education setting. There's also the strategies that we can talk about in terms of collaborating with community partners and developing, whether it's workshops or educational materials or campaigns or other kinds of strategies you can think about in your community. So today I will spend about the next 20 minutes or so going through the brief, which is, again, posted on, it's on the very front page of fyi.uwex.edu/financial series. So it's called Protecting Elders from Financial Abuse, posted on just last week. There's going to be an MP3 file, which is an audio file of this whole conversation posted on that website too. So if you're tuning in today live and you want to go back later and re-listen to it, or if you want to share some of the comments that are made in the audio file, you can actually listen to the MP3. It'll be posted there in about the next week or so. So hopefully folks were able to get the Protecting Elders from Financial Abuse PDF document, which is linked in the green box called Issue Brief. Does anybody have any trouble finding that? Or okay, hearing none, I will assume that it's reachable for folks to find. I want to begin actually with some context of some research that's come out that's not actually in the brief, but there are links on the main website there and the posting here. One is for a study that came out just last week from the FINRA, which is a regulator of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority for securities dealers and others in the financial industry. They had funded some research to try to put some descriptive statistics around the scale of financial fraud in the United States. And so it wasn't just focused on the elderly. It was sort of across the age spectrum. But the report found, first of all, that financial fraud is more common than we might think and probably underreported. In fact, they suggested in the study that it might be underreported by about half. So whatever we find in surveys is only half of what we actually would see if we were able to truthfully measure it. The other is that financial fraud is much more likely to occur for people who are 65 and older. And so this targeting of the elderly, of seniors, of people who have money oftentimes because they have been saving and they oftentimes have equity in their home and they have other kinds of resources that are they've accumulated over their lifetime of work, and oftentimes are more vulnerable for other reasons, that's emotional or cognitive issues that they might be facing. So, you know, we see direct evidence from this FINRA study, which just came out last week, of both the extent of this problem and of the targeting of the of elders and seniors as a particularly at-risk group. The other piece of research that I linked to on the website is, it's not a new paper, but it's a link here that says about cognitive decline and poor financial management. And this is a paper that's been out for some time now by Samrat Agrawal and colleagues, where they look at financial mistakes that people make over their life cycle. And one of the descriptive facts they bring out in just looking at some of the data on older Americans and their cognitive abilities is that there's about a 50-50 chance that any one of us, by the time, if we're able to make it to the reach of 80, have some cognitive impairment. And that's not just dementia. Dementia is certainly a something that we're diagnosing and finding in seniors at higher rates, but it's also more generalized cognitive decline. You know, our ability to make decisions in the moment comes diminished. And so you add together the fact that seniors have resources and their cognitive abilities begin to decline, it makes them particularly susceptible to abuse that might occur. So I think those two pieces of research, I think, are good indicators of why this is an important topic, and one that may be of particular interest as you think about the needs in your communities. I'm not going to turn to the brief and go through some of the topics in that, beginning with just how do we define financial abuse. And I think one of the things I'll come back to several times here is oftentimes the example of financial abuse that you might have in your mind is grandma who's taken by the door-to-door salesman or a telemarketer, you know, a stranger who somehow convinces an older person to hand over some money or to write a check or do something else that's fraudulent. And certainly that is a concern, and those are the cases that we see in the media and that make us angry. But most frequently, the kinds of financial abuse that we see taking place are among family and among caregivers and among people who are trusted by the senior who's being abused. So, you know, this could be a sibling, this could be offspring, it could be a spouse. So the most common abuse are when a senior with resources is taken advantage of by somebody who's close to them, who in some cases may have the legal ability to take advantage of these things, but don't have the consent and don't have the you know, the buy-in of the senior themselves for uses of money or for to use the senior's money for their own personal kinds of activities. So that's one thing to bear in mind is that we're not just talking about, you know, a fraudster who comes along and takes advantage of an older person, but it oftentimes is somebody in the family, a caregiver, or even a spouse in some cases. What do we mean when we talk about financial abuse? You know, essentially it's taking the senior's resources without their consent, for not the benefit of the senior, but for the benefit of the abuser. So, you know, the outright theft is an obvious one where we, you know, we take money or we take things away from the senior, and they may or may not be cognizant of it, but we those things disappear. And that's, I mean, obviously a threat of a theft that can be hard to notice by the senior. It can oftentimes be noticed by family or caregivers, but one of the common things to see is that. Sometimes it's not just money or possessions. It might also be you know, a case we see in some situations where caregivers might be pilfering drugs that then have a resale on the marketplace, or, you know, another way is taking things that might be part of their normal context. You know, administering medication might be part of what they do anyway, and just keeping some of those for their own use or for resale. So that's one case. Another is using debit or credit cards, again, which you can see quite often happening. If you have a caregiver who's, say, running to the grocery store or doing other kinds of personal errands for an elder, if they're not able to leave the house or if they're not physically able to do those things, it's real easy to see how a caregiver might use that debit or credit card that belongs to the elder to make purchases for themselves, to throw a few things in for themselves, and then that might cascade and over time to become more of use, where they're buying, you know, a computer or a TV or something else with those accounts. Another example of the kinds of things we see is where perhaps an elder has a joint account with their offspring or their spouse, and then the other party uses that joint account for things that are purely in their own self-interest. So one of the common mistakes that somebody might make if they're taking care of their, say, their parents' finances is to make themselves a loan and say, you know, I'm having trouble making ends meet, so I'll just use mom's account and write myself a check. And it'll be a loan, and I'll pay it back. I promise I'll pay it back. And then, you know, that's essentially a theft. Without an agreement in place between the elder and the offspring, that is a potentially very problematic situation. It's very easy for that loan to slide and then become a gift without ever making that an explicit gift with the elder themselves.
Michael, this is Cliff. Can you hear me?
Hello?
This is Cliff. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a question. Is there a form that could be used then by a senior to loan money to a child?
So there are ways to do interfamily loans and to make them official. I mean, essentially, it's just a loan contract.
Okay.
The difficulty that can come into some of these loans is the tax treatment. And so it's oftentimes hard to, if you ever have if you're in an educator role and you have either the offspring or the elder who talks about how they want to structure a loan, it's oftentimes best to defer them to somebody who understands the tax law and or the legal ramifications of it, because if the loan is below market rate, and the IRS has some rules about how they set that, it essentially becomes a gifting. And then there's lots of rules in the IRS code about how much you can give. You can actually give quite a bit to your offspring. But when the loan itself is sort of completely ad hoc and the elder themselves doesn't have any knowledge of it, then it quickly becomes something that's not quite legal. And could be something that the other heirs, say in an estate, might object to and actually bring charges around. So, Cliff, thanks for your question. I encourage other folks as they go along, if they have questions, to chime in. Forging checks is another example of where a family member might begin to do this out of some sense of goodwill. You know, mom's not feeling well. I got to get the bills paid, so I'll just sign for her. Unless you're actually part of the account, it's not legal. And then it's real easy for that to become a slippery slope where you said, well, I forged a check for the rent. I can forge a check to myself to make a car repair. And so I think, we have to be careful in these situations because it's easy for the behavior, which it may be began as a way to help out, becomes a way to help yourself. Power of attorney is a particularly problematic one. I know there's folks here at UW who've studied this a lot and how power of attorney can be abused. And, there's oftentimes the powers of attorney that are granted are so broad-reaching that, you're actually granting quite a bit of authority to the third party to sign into contracts and to take on loans and other kinds of things on your behalf. It's part of what we encourage most seniors to do as part of their estate planning is to make sure somebody has power of attorney so in case they're incapacitated, somebody can make decisions for them. But it's something that has to be closely monitored. And what we particularly worry about is when, say, a caregiver convinces an elder to enter into a power of attorney so that they can begin, again, perhaps to do things that are helpful. But that's not their primary motivation. Their motivation is actually to be able to use their power of attorney for personal gain. The last thing we'll see in some cases is changing a will or an inheritance, but without the consent of elder. So working with an attorney or somehow other, you know, actually changing documents directly, forging them in some cases, to add in another beneficiary who is not the intention of the senior in that case. And you can see in all these cases how easy it can be for particularly somebody in a family, somebody who's trusted, to take advantage of a senior, perhaps not even intending in the beginning any kind of malfeasance, but once realizing the power that they hold, beginning to get in a situation where it's kind of a slippery slope and they get themselves into more and more trouble potentially. Now, oftentimes the kinds of cases that I'm talking about where, you know, a check is forged or a power of attorney is forged or a document is forged, I mean, those are eventually caught. The question is whether they're caught soon enough. So somebody in the family may figure this out as the estate's being settled, but they, you know, they didn't catch those earlier. And so, you know, that's a problem, is that there may be no way to go back and try to find out if there's going to be any restitution made. But in other cases, it's not caught. You know, the small thefts, the uses of accounts for small personal items, those are items that may never get caught, and especially in the case of, say, a caregiver and there's no family sort of oversight in close proximity. You know, that can go on for years. It may not be noticeable in terms of draining the bank account, but essentially is a form of abuse that can be perpetrated on elders as they age. I'll stop there and see if there's any questions before we talk a bit further. Okay. You know, I think one of the things that we have to also keep in mind is that the seniors may know that this is abuse is going on, or they may not know. And if you, say, as the sibling, come along and you note it and you bring it up to your parent or to your brother or sister, or as a in the case of a child, to your parent, the senior may deny it. They may say, "Oh no, that this person couldn't possibly do that. I trust them," and so they may not be willing to go along. And really, if they aren't willing to go along, then it's going to be hard to find any kind of at least legal prosecution, although you could certainly confront the abuser. But in some cases, the senior may know what's going on. They may know that their resources are being drained for the benefit of the abuser. But they need that person in their life for whatever reason, whether it's for transportation or for caregiving or for, you know, just taking care of things for them. And so, you know, they may see this as just sort of a cost of getting old, and they just go along with it. It's a particularly powerless position to be in when you are unable to do things for yourself. You rely on other people to do it for you, and you just have to go along with it. And I think it's you know, one of the more troubling aspects of this kind of abuse is that the abused may just not report it because they're afraid of the ramifications of that, of losing the help, or of even potentially being physically or other ways threatened by the abuser in these cases. The other side of this is that the abuser may not see what they're doing as abuse. They may say, you know, I put up with so much in dealing with this older person, and, you know, some of the tasks that you have to do aren't pleasant when you're dealing with taking care of an elder. You know, the hours aren't necessarily friendly. You know, there's lots of things that are inconvenient. And so why couldn't I get a little bit of extra? You know, it seems like this senior has so much money, I'll never miss it anyway. And, you know, that may start off as an extraordinary once, you know, I'll just only do this once, and then become a pattern that's repeated and becomes a habit. And then, like I said, it's a slippery slope, and it's very difficult on both sides to really know what the intentions were. But, you know, ultimately, if the senior isn't in control of their funds and the funds aren't being used for their best interest, it could very well be something that's construed as being abusive. There's a survey conducted a couple of years ago about the incidence of financial abuse, and it really only focused on abuse by family members, because we think that's the most prevalent form of abuse is by family members. It showed about 1 in 20 seniors reporting that they themselves have been abused by a family member financially, so it's about 5%. Other studies show it's as much as 9 or 10%, so about twice that rate. And, you know, the The FINRA data might suggest that even that's off by half, so maybe we have an abuse rate of up to 20% if you were to include non-family member abuse and other kinds of abuse that might have occurred. So we don't exactly know how common this is. I think the low end estimate is around 5% of seniors. The upper end estimate is around 20% of seniors. I mean, frankly, even if it's the only low end, the 5% who are abused by family members, that's big enough to be worried about, particularly when we know that financial resources are often tight for seniors anyway, that resources are particularly needed at end of life for care and medical conditions and those kinds of things. So, you know, it begins to be problematic from an economic standpoint, but also just from a sort of moral or social justice standpoint, that these are people who are highly vulnerable, and we worry about a situation in our communities where these people can be taken advantage of when they're not safe from the kinds of abuse. The table in the brief at the table one on top of page two looks at the most common forms of abuse. And these are reported by seniors. So the two most common ones we see are spending money without permission and then making poor decisions with money. So in both cases, you can see how the senior and the abuser, or, you know, the accused abuser in this case, could simply be in a conflict. So, you know, I make decisions about my mom's money and I decide that she needs a car repair because the brakes aren't safe. She says, the brakes are fine, I don't need new brakes, and so we have a conflict. So that's different from, using money for my own benefit. So I spend the money to repair the brakes on my car, which she never rides in or, in any way gets any use out of. So, I mean, there's room for interpretation on how some of these things are seen by both sides. The incidence of actual stealing or of forcing or forging signatures are much less common than simply disputes over how money is spent. And a lot of the kinds of abuse are, each incident's relatively small. A little bit of cash here and there, a little bit of throwing some extra things onto the checkout counter when they're using the elder's debit card, for example, those kinds of small abuse, which could be cumulative, more cumulative over time. This same study where the table one comes from, they actually tried to look at when is abuse most likely, so which seniors are most likely to report having these kinds of abuses. The most common cases are when the senior has more limitations, so if they're not able to engage in activities of daily living, things like being able to get dressed and get out of bed, those kinds of activities, they're much more likely to be abused, and you can kind of see how that would happen because their mobility is more limited, they're not able to actually manage their finances or to do their shopping themselves. And the other is seniors who have no access to social services. It was a lesser effect than having disabilities, but still a prominent one. Again, the most common reasons why seniors are targeted for these kinds of abuses is because they have some resources, oftentimes in a savings account or in other kinds of assets. They also have steady income. They oftentimes have fixed income from Social Security and pension, so there's money coming in on a regular basis. And then they just have more dependence on others as their both physical and cognitive abilities decline. We also know that seniors are less likely to know exactly how much they have in their particularly checking and savings accounts, and they may not know, for example, in their investment accounts how much the accounts have grown, and so they don't recognize that in the last year it's been 8 or 9% growth, and so if some of that were to disappear, they wouldn't notice. And so we have some issues just in terms of attention to the details on accounts in those kinds of cases. And then obviously anybody who's got limited disabilities, it puts them in more of a position where they can't monitor, they're not taking care of all their basic services, and somebody else is in a position where they can be taken advantage of. I'm going to move now to a little bit of discussion of how do we notice when financial abuse is coming about. And one of the things I got interested in this topic is because I was at a meeting with some people from financial institutions who were saying that their frontline bank tellers were noticing financial abuse. And I sort of thought to myself, how would they see financial abuse? And they gave a number of different scenarios where it's very obvious to the professional at the financial institution that abuse is going on. So a senior comes in to the bank with somebody who seems out of place, to cash checks, particularly checks made out to cash. A senior who seems very nervous or agitated when they're trying to get funds out. You know, somebody who's at the counter with their caregiver, and their caregiver is the one who's trying to sort of force the transaction to get through. Withdrawals at really weird times. So if somebody who's got limited mobility is using a walk-up ATM at 2 in the morning, that's a warning signal. It's unlikely that senior would be able to do that, or using an ATM across town, or using a debit card at places that the senior would normally wouldn't shop. The bank account or the bank teller or the person, the professional who works at a financial institution, might also see requests to add a co-account holder or have a power of attorney on an account or to have documents with different beneficiaries. And so in many ways, the financial institution professional is at the front line. At least in Wisconsin, they're not mandated to report those kinds of things, but they do notice them. And so I would say, as you think about community-based education activities, working with your local credit union, local community bank, and other institutions, there might be some cross-training opportunities and some programmatic opportunities in working with institutions as well. Other places that we, you know, other warning signs you'll see are, you know, suspicious signatures, a lot of large purchases for gifts, things that are sort of out of the ordinary from what that letter might be, transfers across accounts, particularly from the elder's account to external accounts, bills that aren't getting paid, in some cases because the checking account or the main account that would be used to pay the bills has been drained, so there's non-sufficient funds where there hasn't been a problem in the past. You know, older accounts that all of a sudden become active, or withdrawals or sales of, say, CDs with a penalty for early withdrawal, and yet they're still being cashed out early. So those are all examples of the kinds of things that we might see as warning signs about something going on. All right, so let's talk a little about the prevention and then a little bit about the education side of what can be done. You know, in terms of working with your own parents or, you know, thinking about yourself, the most important thing to do is plan ahead and to make sure you simplify your financial management so you don't need a great deal of help. Make sure that your documents are very well organized, that you share them with your family members, that you have easy ways to monitor accounts, that you don't have dozens of accounts that you have to keep track of, because then it's much easier to know sort of where you're at and where each account is. You know, perhaps in some cases, for people who have a more complicated situation or don't have somebody they can trust nearby, it might be paying a CPA or a bank or a credit union or trust department to actually help you manage your money. And so as we think about this whole issue of cognitive decline as people age, this is a true service. It's not a cheap service by any means. And there's a range of different, you know, you can go everything from a trust service that actually pays every bill for you to, you know, a trust service that manages your overall accounts with some transfers into a transaction account that you yourself would still manage. So there's a range of different services and range of different costs. But that can oftentimes be a strategy that some seniors need to engage in. And the last thing is just using direct deposit. And in fact, the less reliant seniors are on paper checks and having to go to the bank and cash checks and sign checks, the more that funds can be electronically transferred. Oftentimes that reduces the ability of fraud in various forms to be taken advantage of. The next thing is to stay on top of the finances. So keeping documents in a safe place, not lending out IDs. You know, if you do have to have a caregiver make purchases for you, set up a separate prepaid debit card to make those purchases so that if they do abuse that card, there's a limit to how much they can spend. So that, say that prepaid debit card only has $400 or $500 on it, and if you find that the person's abusing the card, you just cancel the card. And so there's some limits in terms of how much damage that can be done. Obviously, keeping track of bank statements. More and more banks and financial institutions are moving to online bank statements, which makes it easier for family to monitor accounts, but oftentimes harder for seniors to monitor accounts if they have to go online to get them. So making sure that you still get statements in paper sometimes for a senior is an important strategy. Passwords can be a major issue. Most of us are not good about password management. I know my mom is 85, turning 86. She has all her passwords written on a Post-it right next to her computer. Probably not a great strategy. So, you know, making sure that some strategies are in place to manage passwords and those kinds of things. Another thing we see with seniors is they'll oftentimes have more credit cards or debit cards than they use. They've accumulated them over the years. They've gotten them from different stores. They've gotten them sent to them sort of unsolicited in some cases. And so one important strategy is to just narrow that down to just a handful of cards that can be easily managed and destroy and cancel the other ones. Text and email alerts are also an important strategy so that both the senior and trusted family members can get a basically an email or a text that says, you know, a transaction over this amount has occurred, or there's a bill past due or something else to keep on track of these kinds of things. Did I hear a question? All right, I will press on. Third is, I think we hear this a lot, but seniors are oftentimes trusting. When somebody calls, they'll pick up the phone and they'll listen, and in some cases, if they're alone, they're, you know, actually eager for some conversation. And so, you know, one of the reasons we see some cases we see abuse of seniors is simply because they picked up the phone and it was a fraudster on the other end of the phone. And so we want to always emphasize that, you know, you might want to trust but verify, that you should never be pressured into entering any kind of transaction, whether it's a home repair or investment or anything else, that we want to be careful of these, you know, today only or last chance. You know, if you don't do this now, you're going to lose your opportunity. And then one of the most egregious ones we've seen recently are when a senior is called by somebody who claims to be their grandson or granddaughter, and they're, you know, don't tell mom, I went with my friends to Mexico, I'm in trouble, I got arrested, or something happened, I need $500 to get home, can you wire it to me? And, you know, the good ones can play this game pretty well, and, you know, they trick the grandparent into wiring the money. There was a recent ring that was busted that was active in Wisconsin. I think it was based actually in Montreal. It was a $200 million fraud that they had going. They had a big call center where they were just doing this over and over and over again. And unfortunately, we recently had a presentation from the Attorney General, or the Assistant Attorney General in Wisconsin, who described that while they busted up the ring has been replicated. So now it's active somewhere else, and, you know, that scam still is out there. So, you know, not that many people were affected, but it's, you know, certainly the sophistication of the operation is alarming. Fourth is just guarding personal information. So Social Security numbers, which I think we've all talked a lot about in the past, about being careful about both Social Security numbers, but also account numbers, PIN numbers, ATM numbers, passwords. You know, all these things are things that we want to keep close. And then anytime anybody's asking for those on the phone should be a warning signal as well. And so that, you know, when somebody calls you unsolicited and starts to ask for that kind of information, you know, we want to try to get the word out that that's not a conversation you want to engage in, that if they want that information, they can send you information or you can call them back. You know, unless it's a really reputable institution that you have a record with, it's not information we want to share. The other thing that we've talked about on these calls before, and it's part of the 2266-1010 campaign to check your credit report, is to follow up and check your credit report 3 times a year at annualcreditreport.com. Those credit reports will let you know when there's inquiries, you know, when there's been activity in an account. And so that can be an activity to engage in with the senior 3 times a year to check that site, to check the report and see where it's at, see if there's any activity. And, you know, oftentimes seniors don't check because they figure they don't use any credit. But the point isn't to see what their credit activity is, just to make sure there's anything on there that shouldn't be there. I'll talk a little bit about reporting, and I put a link on the main website for the National Elder Care Locator. There's both an online search and there's a 1-800 number. You know, reporting elder care or reporting abuse is tricky because oftentimes, as I mentioned, it is a family member or somebody who's trusted. The elder themselves don't want to report the abuse because they're afraid of the backlash. And you know, at least in Wisconsin, financial professionals aren't obligated to do it, although most voluntarily will. It's not always obvious, though, for these professionals where they should make the report to. So in this state, every county has a fund agency who will facilitate those reports when they come through. So as an educator, that might be one of your roles, is to make sure that the parties that might notice this kind of abuse, whether they're caregivers or financial institutions or family members, has a way to begin to make those reports known when they occur. There's some other links under the further resources as well that provide some more information about how to report abuse when it comes up. Okay, so the last topic is around education. And so how might you use this as an educator in your community? And I'll wrap up in a couple of minutes, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this too, on what either you've done or what you could do. I mean, obviously, one is to do workshops with seniors directly. There are two links that I put on the website. One is from the National Council on Aging. They have a curriculum on avoiding fraud. It's a two-session curriculum. They call it Savvy Saving Seniors, which is a tough one to say fast. So the first curriculum is designed really around saving and managing your finances. And the second curriculum is, they call it Toolkit 2, is on steps to avoid scams. And that was the one I draw your attention to. It's created by a national organization called WISER, the Women's Institute for Secure Retirement, very well-respected national organization. They did have some bank funding to do this, but it really was independently developed. It's very high quality. They have evaluation forms. They have a handbook. They have PowerPoint slides. They have a training guide. So it really is about as turnkey as can be for you as you think about performing workshops. There is an Elder Financial Protection Network, which is, again, a nonprofit national organization. Their website is BeWise Online, but they have some brochures in both English and Spanish, which you can reproduce and use to try to promote some of the ideas that I've talked about on this call and that they talk about in their own materials. The FDIC, many of you know, there's the Money Smart curriculum for financial education. They actually have a Money Smart for older adults, and it's something that is being developed sort of as we speak in partnership with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So currently there's some information posted on the FDIC website, and I put a link to that, and then more information at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau website, and so there's a link to both of those. This is a participant guide that's available there in addition to the materials on the Money Smart website. So it's about a 50-page document that's up there, and they're going to be continuing to further develop this and build out the Money Smart for older adults, they call it MSOA, over the next year. So keep an eye out for that. But I think they're going to be great materials. If you use Money Smart, then you'll be pretty familiar with the final product as this comes out of that as well. I think the other strategies that are potentially useful to think about is how to train professionals in the community around recognizing signs of abuse and what to do when they see signs of financial abuse among elders. So whether that's understanding the reporting hotline or how referrals are made, also helping family members recognize, as well as seniors themselves recognize when abuse might be occurred, but also among caregivers. So, working with the networks of service providers who are working with the aged and elderly in communities to recognize when that abuse might be occurring, and also to how to avoid even the perception that they might be taking advantage of their clients in their own work. And so making clear sort of when certain behaviors or certain activities that they might be involved in, while they might be well-meaning, could be construed as being for their own personal benefit without the consent of the senior, and make sure they have some safeguards in place to prevent that from happening. I think the last would be to work with some financial institutions and to, oftentimes this is a concern for financial institutions. They oftentimes, if you go to some institutions during the day, the only users that come in, the only clients that come in are older people. A lot of young people don't step foot in banks anymore. So for community-based financial institutions, this is oftentimes an audience that they care a lot about. Seniors are a key market for them because they still keep savings accounts, whereas, many other populations don't. And so this can be a nice way to develop a community-based partnership with financial institutions on a topic that everybody is pretty motivated around, both from a community impact standpoint and then from the financial decision standpoint from their own bottom line. So, with that, I'll stop, and I encourage both questions as well as ideas for strategies that you might be pursuing or strategies that you might be thinking about pursuing in your own community.
Michael, would you again give the name of that curriculum that you thought was excellent?
So the National Council on Aging, and I put the link on the FYI at uwexau.edu/financialseries website. National Accounting on Aging has a website. It's a very long string, so I won't read it off, but you can find the link on the website. But it's called Savvy Saving Seniors. And then Toolkit 2 is the Steps to Avoiding Scams, which is developed by Wiser, the Women's Institute for Secure Retirement. And they have, they're really good materials. And you can download them and use them, and you can also order for a fee the printed copies as well. And like I said, the FDIC Money Smart is in development of their older Money Smart for older adults. So there are materials being developed now. They have posted their preliminary materials there now. It's not as fully developed as the other, if you're familiar with Money Smart, it's not as well developed as some of their other materials yet, but I think we'll see pretty rapid development of those over the next, 6 months or so.
Hi, this is Peggy in Richland. I'm just wondering if any of our colleagues online have been doing any kind of outreach services on seniors and financial scams or mismanagement, or working with their Aging and Disability Resource Center or anything like that. I'm just looking for some ideas for outreach.
This is Gail from Polk, and I'm doing next week end of life issues with ADRC, and we do have a bank coming in and talking about financial matters. This year it's on reverse mortgages and protecting your account.
Gail, that sounds like something you do every year.
Other examples that folks have of engagement in their communities?
I'm just wondering if anyone who uses the like caregiver training or the curriculum has any type of information on financial scams in there.
No, that's very limited as far as being specific with financial. It's more on stress management and communication. You're referring to powerful tools for caregivers.
Yes, that was it. Thank you.
One of the other resources that we expect to see coming out, and it may even be this calendar year, from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is to guide the fiduciary, quote-unquote fiduciaries, the son or daughter who's managing their parents' money, in terms of how to put safeguards in place and not get yourself into trouble, not start down that slippery slope, so that you don't violate, sort of both the law as well as the best practices in terms of how you manage money on behalf of somebody else without either having the perception of personal gain or, getting yourself in a position where you begin to become reliant on what was supposed to be an extraordinary circumstance one time. So I expect to see that out from the CFPB before the end of the year. All right, any other questions or comments or sharing that folks want to do? Okay, well, I want to thank everybody for being on the phone today. This call will be archived, so the audio will be posted on the FYI website with these other materials. October, we're going to have, the third Monday, a completely different focus. On the other end of the age spectrum, we're going to talk about preschool-age children and families and strategies for financial education. So there'll be a brief posted a few days in advance. And then the same as today, we'll have about a, 30-35 or so minute presentation, and then time for discussion afterwards. So thanks, everybody. Have a great week.
Hold on, Michael.
Yes.
This is Barb Haynes, and I have a friend in Minnesota who is working. Her mother was scammed out of, I think it was $47,000, by someone calling to say she had won some money and, had to start paying to receive it. And my friend is working with Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota to get some kind of legislation passed at the federal level related to scam.
Yeah, I think this has become a very popular topic on a national basis. So I think we're going to see a lot of action both at the state and national level. Okay, with that, I will wish everybody a good week, and I'll talk to you in a month.